From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This morning, President Trump tweeted his response to fired FBI Director James Comey's forthcoming book. Trump writes, "James Comey is a proven leaker and liar," in caps. Virtually everyone in Washington thought he should be fired for the terrible job he did until he was, in fact, fired. He leaked classified information for which he should be prosecuted. He lied to Congress under oath. He is a weak and untruthful slimeball who was, as time has proven, a terrible director of the FBI. His handling of the crooked Hillary Clinton case and the events surrounding it will go down as one of the worst botched jobs of history. It was my great honor to fire James Comey. Well, for his part, Comey in the book describes Trump as unethical and a congenital liar. He calls the Trump presidency a forest fire. Comey was fired by Trump in May. Comey says it was after he refused to pledge loyalty and to agree to drop the investigation into Trump aide Michael Flynn. His much-anticipated memoir, A Higher Loyalty, will be released on Tuesday. NPR has a copy. NPR's Ryan Lucas has read it. Ryan, your impressions?
Well, there aren't a ton of surprises in the book, but certainly if you were looking for Comey to go easy on Trump, you're not going to get that. Comey takes a very kind of tough line on Trump, paints this damning portrait of him. As you noted, calls him unethical, untethered to the truth and institutional values, and basically spells out why Comey thinks Trump poses a risk to the country.
Okay.
One thing that struck a lot of people is this comparison that he makes, saying that Trump is like an organized crime boss in kind of his leadership style. And coming from Comey, that's somebody who worked mob cases when he was a federal prosecutor.
Well, and part of that is that he says it feels to him like those mobs where everybody cocoons themselves in lies until they actually believe the lies. But let's get the tawdry out of the way. And as you say, all of this has been out in bits and pieces. But Comey writes that Trump was fixated on the so-called Steele dossier. This alleges that Trump watched prostitutes in an act in a Moscow hotel room. NPR has decided we won't be describing the act the prostitutes were in, but Comey writes that Trump wanted him to knock this claim down because Comey says Trump told him, "I'm a germaphobe. I'd never do that." Salacious, but what are the serious questions here about Trump allegedly asking an FBI director to knock something down?
Well, I mean, you do have the point of asking him to knock something down, and that's not really something that the FBI would be doing. You have other questions that the president asked of James Comey, which are far more problematic, such as the question of loyalty or the question of asking him to go easy on Flynn. I think what's kind of interesting if you want to talk about the dossier is when Comey briefed the president on the dossier. And this came after a briefing about the whole kind of Russian interference campaign. He says that Trump and his team weren't interested in the interference itself. They were interested in how to spin the interference, about how to talk about how it didn't impact the result. And Comey said that they weren't interested in discussing, you know, how to respond to Russia's interference in the election. And he found that really striking.
More treating it as a PR problem rather than a national security issue.
Exactly.
Comey says his decision to tell Congress that the FBI had reopened the investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails just days before the election was because he thought she was going to win and he didn't want it to seem as if he held it back. But, of course, his detractors will say he did not announce that there was an ongoing investigation into possible connections between the Trump campaign and the Russians. As you said, no surprises, really. Is there anything new or anything about possible collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia, which is what Robert Mueller's subsequent investigation now is?
Well, he doesn't get into the Russia investigation. He really focuses on the period of time when really the interactions that we already knew that he had with the president. These are the interactions that he talked about when he testified before Congress. So many of these things are known, but what he does provide is more detail, more kind of fly on the wall perspective as to how those conversations went, and also conversations not with the president but with then Attorney General Loretta Lynch back during the Obama administration, and conversations that they had regarding the Clinton email investigation.
It's pretty damning too of people like Jeff Sessions. Comey describes a scene in which Trump asks Sessions to clear a room so Trump can talk privately to Comey. Comey says to Sessions, "Don't do that." Comey describes Sessions as looking around furtively and then acquiescing. Has that community, in just a few seconds, has that community responded?
There hasn't been much of a response from that community, no. But what there has been a response from is Trump supporters, of course, who say that you can't take Comey's account of history.
Because they say he's a disgruntled fired employee. Ryan Lucas, who covers the Justice Department for NPR, thank you.
Thank you.
And now to Texas, where an alleged arsonist is about to go on trial for a hate crime. He's accused of burning down a mosque in the small oil town of Victoria. The mosque was set on fire more than a year ago. In the past year, there have been more than 100 incidents, threats, vandalism, or arson at mosques all around the country. NPR's Leila Fadel went to Victoria and reports on how different generations in the mosque are recovering.
It's Friday at the Victoria Islamic Center in this town of about 62,000 people southeast of San Antonio, a place where God is a big part of life for almost everyone. And for Muslims in Victoria, Friday means prayer and potluck. Kids play together on the floor.
But they don't come anymore.
Yeah, they usually don't come anymore.
Because they're shy, but, like, it's going
to
happen.
What's going to happen? Like, yeah. They don't know.
That's Reza Kadri and Barir Saif talking about their friends who don't come to the mosque. Their parents are afraid. They're in one of two connected trailer homes. The old mosque is gone. The new one's being built. On this day, about 70 people pack the trailers. The aluminum mobile homes are the prayer space, the community rooms, the dining room, and everything else.
It's hard. I mean, some of us really were so attached to see your, you know, a place of worship really go down in the smoke and ashes.
That's Shahid Hashmi, a surgeon and one of the founders of this mosque that opened in 2000. He's lived in Victoria since 1984.
We have been involved with the community, and community has been involved with us. And that's where I think the greatest support came with this tragedy.
Overwhelming support in the days after the attack, he says.
We had already raised $500,000 in 24 hours. Unbelievable.
Ultimately, they would raise over $1 million from people in 90 countries, both Muslims and non-Muslims. After we talk, Hashmi rejoins the others for food. The table's filled with everything from spice biryani to seven-layer dip.
I'm an army brat. My mother was from a town that's about 45 minutes from here.
That's Heidi Ajrami. Her husband Abe is on the Islamic Center's board, and their kids take religion classes here. The potluck wraps up. Everyone prays, and the Ajramis invite me to their house the next day.
Hello.
Hi.
Come on in.
Heidi says in the last few years, it's become a bit scary to be visibly Muslim. So she doesn't drive to the mosque with her scarf on anymore. She teaches at the local college and at work.
Don't talk about it now. It's just something that I don't even bring up because the mood is different.
She says President Trump unmasked a lot of hate toward Muslims and others. He proposed a ban on Muslims entering the country during his campaign. And their mosque was burned within hours of the first iteration of his travel ban that listed only Muslim-majority countries.
It really took that bad incident for me to come out and say, I am a Muslim, hello, I didn't, you know, before that. I
was like, that's Abe, Heidi's husband. Now, he didn't hide he was Muslim, he just didn't talk about it. But looking at the rubble of his mosque, he says, he knew he couldn't do that anymore. Now, he's more willing to be really public about his religion and speaks about it whenever people ask.
You have to, like, take a deep breath and not let it get to you, because at some point you do question yourself, why am I doing it? Why do I have to prove to you that I'm a good guy? You know, it's like...
Especially, Abe says, when he's constantly asked to respond to fringe violent groups that have become what Muslims are in the minds of a lot of people. A new study by a think tank that does research on issues that affect American Muslims says attacks by Muslims or people perceived to be Muslim get significantly more media attention. And so Abe says with 1.8 billion Muslims in the world, he's asked to answer for the acts of a tiny slice of people doing terrible things.
I think we're relying on these people, the second generation and third generation, that they grew up here, they understand the system, they're eloquent, or I think things are changing.
When he says these people, he means his three kids and other U.S.-born Muslims like them. The climate seems to invigorate them. Janine, their daughter in high school, says at first she just didn't talk about her religion.
I didn't want to, like,
have to feel that discrimination.
But over the last year, she started talking to her classmates about her faith.
I like telling them just so I can, like, if they say something, you know, like racist or Islamophobic, I can, like, shut them down.
Her sister Hannah nods.
I feel like people on the outside have this kind of image of what a Muslim woman looks like.
Hannah says she's embraced all the things that make her who she is: Palestinian, American, Texan, Muslim. And now she's seeing versions of herself and the people she knows in fashion, television, and politics.
That, you know, you're not alone, even if you're in a small town in South Texas with not a big, you know, Arab or even Muslim population. There's people all over the world who are going through the same things that you are.
She says she's not trying to fit in anymore. She's embracing what makes her different. Leila Fadel, NPR News.
The Simpsons has been on TV for nearly 30 years. The series is a critical success and occasionally the subject of controversy. The latest involves the character Apu. He's an Indian immigrant, and he's been voiced all these years by a comedian who is white. Critics say Apu's depiction has contributed to racial stereotypes against South Asian Americans. In last week's episode, the show obliquely responded. And NPR TV critic Eric Deggans is here to talk about it. First, Eric, for those who don't know, who is Apu?
So Apu is an Indian immigrant who owns a convenience store in the show called a Quickie Mart, kind of loosely based on a 7-Eleven. And he's been voiced by this white comedian, Hank Azaria. According to Azaria, the producers asked him to come up with the most offensive voice he could come up with. And so he came up with this sort of pidgin Indian dialect.
Here's a little sampling from The Simpsons.
Mr. Simpson, please pay for your purchases and get out and come again.
Now, the issue around this character, Apu, has been brought to light by a comedian. Tell us about this.
So this comedian, Hari Kondabolu, created a film called The Problem with Apu. And in that film, he sort of pursued the idea of, you know, how did this character get created? And so over the years, they have, you know, fleshed out the character, added a backstory. We've seen his family. They've given a more nuanced portrayal. But in the early seasons of the show especially, he was very much a stereotype. And this film talked about the impact that that had on South Asian people. And Harry gathered together a bunch of actors that you would recognize to say that when they were younger, they were often made fun of and told that they resembled this character.
So True TV has announced the documentary is going to be airing again this Sunday in light of the recent controversy or the re-arising of the controversy. How has The Simpsons as a program responded to Hari's portrayal in the documentary?
Well, there was a scene in The Simpsons episode that just aired on Sunday. It's believed to be an attempt to address this controversy. Basically, the mother, Marge Simpson, is reading a bedtime story to the daughter, Lisa. And it's a classic story, but Marge is trying to change the details of it to make it more palatable to people in 2018. And then there's a moment where Lisa sort of speaks up and kind of denounces, seems to denounce the idea of changing a classic story to meet modern concerns. And I think we have a clip. Let's check it out. Yeah.
Since she's already evolved, she doesn't really have an emotional journey to complete.
Nope.
Kind of means there's no point to the book.
Well, what am I supposed to do?
It's hard to say. Something that started decades ago and was applauded and inoffensive is now politically incorrect. What can you do?
Some things will be dealt with at a later date.
If at all.
And then the camera sort of pans over to a picture of Apu, and underneath it there's a line that says, "Don't have a cow, man."
So they're kind of
Bart Simpson's off. Classic phrase, yeah.
So they're kind of waving off the concern.
Yeah, and there's so much to unpack about what's so wrong about that scene, right? I mean, first of all, the idea that the concern about the character is just about political correctness, which is often a way of sort of shrugging off the concerns of people who want to talk about diversity, want to talk about stereotyping, want to talk about prejudice. It's a way of minimizing it. It's a weird way of punching down because this is a show that's been on the air. It's been on Fox for nearly 30 years. The characters have been around longer than that. This episode was co-written by Matt Groening, the guy who created The Simpsons. And it just completely sidestepped the actual issue or any discussion of it. And ultimately, having Lisa, who's sort of the conscience of the show, been the conscience of the show for since its inception, having her say that the character was deemed inoffensive when it was created, when there's a documentary with a bunch of South Asian people saying that they didn't feel that way, is a way of sort of telling people of color, you know what? Your concerns don't matter as much as the rich white guys who created this show. To me, it's a demonstration of how far The Simpsons has devolved, that they would even take the time to create a scene like this and think that it would be somehow adding to the discussion about diversity and how characters of color have evolved since The Simpsons debut.
I wonder what you think the proper response, if any response was warranted at all, what the proper response would have been on the part of The Simpsons writers, because The Simpsons has been around for 29 seasons. There are a lot of shows, way back when and now, that exploit racial and sexual stereotypes for laughs. What's the proper way now to respond through this lens?
Well, one thing, be sensitive of the fact that this is a character that's voiced by a white man and seems to have been created by white men. So why not reach out to some prominent South Asian performers and writers and get them to help you craft an episode where you actually take a look at how stereotypical the character was when it was created and how far the character may have come in its portrayals in The Simpsons. Actually reach out to people of color and give them some agency in telling the story, which has always been a problem with Hollywood. But it's easier to shrug it off, and it's easy to pretend that there wasn't a problem when they originally created the character, because, you know, these people don't want to believe that they've done something prejudiced or stereotypical or even racist all those years ago. But the sad fact is that people who aren't racist can often perpetuate stereotypes unknowingly. And part of defeating that is having the strength to look at what you've done and admit when you made a mistake and correct it by talking to the people who are affected by the prejudice that you are echoing. And they have so far refused to do that, and that's their biggest mistake.
Thank you. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Thanks a lot, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
Well, to high culture now, Shakespeare. People have performed the plays of William Shakespeare in parks and prisons, in Elizabethan costumes and modern dress. Every adaptation seems to reveal new meanings. And beginning tomorrow, most PBS stations will air a film about a production of A Midsummer Night's Dream in the Lillian Booth Actors Home, an assisted living facility in Englewood, New Jersey, for retired theater professionals. The documentary is called Still Dreaming. NPR's Ina Jaffe covers aging, and she has this report.
A Midsummer Night's Dream is set in a moonlit forest. That's where four young lovers find themselves tricked and bewitched by fairies and sprites. Identities are confused, jealousies rage, dreaming and waking are hard to tell apart. Of all of Shakespeare's works, this was the play that the residents of the Lillian Booth Actors Home decided they wanted to tackle.
Again, I thought that maybe I'd get a story about love with them doing Midsummer Night's Dream.
But that's not what happened, says Hank Rogerson, who co-directed the documentary Still Dreaming along with his wife, Jillian Spitzmiller. Instead,
what was happening was this whole story about perception and dream versus reality.
Rogerson says the confusion in A Midsummer Night's Dream, the way the characters can't trust their senses, mirrored the daily struggles of the residents who acted the parts.
In dealing with near blindness, poor hearing, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, those challenges create confusion and create a lot of realities.
And those realities sometimes clashed. As you can hear when resident Harold Cherry throws out a question to the group, will we have to memorize our lines? It's a question that fellow actor Demo Kondos doesn't take kindly.
Some people will have difficulties. Well, because some people will have difficulty memorizing.
Are you talking about some people, or are you talking about yourself?
Whatever.
You want to play bottom without memorizing it?
Of course I'm going to memorize it.
Why do you ask? Do I have to memorize? What the hell kind of acting is that? Of course you have to memorize.
Okay.
Trying to hold this all together was Noah Brody, one of the two directors of the stage play that's the subject of the film. Every day, Brody saw ways this entire project could go south.
And then the magic happens. People decide to just go for it, and the audience shows up. And if that sort of electricity and that little squirt of adrenaline go in the right direction, it all just seems to fall into place and becomes an absolute delight. In the moment, of course, it still can feel absolutely, you know, like the Sisyphean task.
In fact, the Lillian Booth Homes administration was concerned that residents would get too stressed out over 6 weeks of rehearsal and consulted with their physicians to make sure they'd be okay. Chief Administrator Jordan Stroll says, as it turned out, he didn't need to worry.
I mean, what we ultimately saw was really some incredible success stories. We had a few residents that came off of various medications, had a reduction in dosages. They felt like they were once again re-engaged in their community, and they had a purpose.
Not everyone in this production had a long career in the theater. For Lynette Luce, a shy woman who played one of the young lovers, this was her first crack at acting.
I would really like to have the nerve to pick up and do something I've never done before. A lot of these people, unlike me, are real artists. They really have played on Broadway. They've done many things, and they've still got it in them.
In the years it took for Still Dreaming to be completed and to make its way to public television, many of the performers we see so vibrant on the screen have passed away, or some, like Lynette Luce, have deteriorated further. But the film is a testament to what they could create despite mental or physical challenges, says Andrew Luce, Lynette Luce's son.
The big takeaway, ultimately, is gratitude and appreciation that we have this document of my mother and the grandmother of my children.
Above all, the film Still Dreaming documents that life's final chapters can still be a time for creativity and new challenges. Ina Jaffe, NPR News.
And as we look ahead to the summer travel season, and we know many of you would just like to get to spring at this point, the price of gas is closing in on a three-year high. The average price at the pump in the U.S. is $2.68 a gallon. That's up 15 cents from a month ago, up nearly 30 cents from a year ago. This is according to AAA. And it has to do with the rising oil prices we've been telling you about. Charisse Jones of USA Today is here. Hi, Charisse.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. And when we talk about this gas costing 30 cents more than it did a year ago, just give us a sense of what this means, how it accumulates for consumers.
For the average U.S. family, they're going to have to spend about $200 more this year for gas than they did last year. And that's not a fortune, but that can pay for a couple of nights at a hotel if you're on vacation or pay another bill. So some families are definitely going to feel it.
Yeah. And some of the people you've spoken with have said, you know, this may impact vacations.
You know, absolutely. I mean, I think people react in a very visceral way when they see that sign at the gas station. They notice if it's a nickel or a dime higher. And it might make some people say, you know, I'm going to have to skip that trip to, you know, the Grand Canyon or some other national park. But at the same time, prices are really a lot lower than they were at the peak back in 2008 in the summer when it got up to $4.11 a gallon. People have a few more dollars in their paychecks because of the tax bill. So a lot of people may still feel comfortable traveling.
Yeah, but talk about, you know, where we are right now. The oil price peaked earlier this week within this cycle after President Trump sent out that tweet suggesting, you know, he's going to be striking Syria. How does that impact oil prices?
You know, Syria is actually a major oil producer in its part of the world in the Eastern Mediterranean.
I just have to interrupt you, Charisse, for a second to say that's amazing that Syria has it together to produce anything, you know, because of what's going on there.
Absolutely. And it probably isn't doing the same kind of output, but it is still in the ball game. Mm. And the Middle East in general, I mean, whenever there's unrest, it's the center of oil production for the world. And so whenever there's turmoil there, that gives them leverage to raise prices and it causes disruption in the supply potentially. And so that can lead to higher prices at the pump.
And we reported a lot on how the U.S. production going up kind of disrupted the market in a good way for people in the U.S. So how is that factoring into all of this?
Well, oil producers in the United States are also cashing in, right? They're increasing their exports because the prices are up. But the problem for us here is that that kind of reduces our supply, and it's not being replenished at the same rate. So that, again, can lead to higher prices, which is great for the oil companies, but not for mom and dad who need to fill up the oil tank to, you know, go to the ball game or go to work.
Right. So we've got about a minute here. Where do you see this going?
You know, I think that, you know, prices are going to probably stay fairly high. They'll probably drop once we get to fall and winter. But for the summer, things are going to be a little bit more costly. Some people are going to take to the road, and others are going to have a staycation and try and save a few dollars.
Yeah. And by the way, you remind us that this peak right now also has to do with the fact that, and we hear this every year, this is the time of year that there's oil refinery maintenance.
Exactly. They're doing that. They're getting ready for the summer gas season, you know, when they do something a little bit different to the formula. So all of those factors go into increasing prices a little bit. So people have to look at their budget and see what they can do once it comes time for vacation.
Sharice Jones of USA Today on, you know, oil prices tickling up a little bit. Sharice, thank you.
Thank you.
An enormous ocean current in the Atlantic that helps regulate the global climate system is slowing down. That's the conclusion of two new studies published in the journal Nature. Scientists disagree about what's behind the weakening ocean circulation, but it could mean troubling news for the climate. David Thornelli is a geologist at University College London and lead author of one of those studies. He's now in the UK. Professor, the current that we're talking about is called AMOC or AMOC. What does that stand for?
That's the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC for short.
AMOC. So the meridional was the key word in there because this is tied to a meridian. Basically, it's like a conveyor belt exchanging warm water from the equator with cold water from the Arctic. Could you paint a picture of this for us? How big is it, for instance?
Yeah, so you can imagine, well, it's part of a global conveyor circulation that's moving water around the Earth. And it's transporting huge volumes of water from the tropics all the way up to the high latitudes, many, many times more volume than the Amazon. And so it plays a key role in the distribution of heat in the Earth and helps keep some of the mid-latitudes warmer than they otherwise would be.
What precisely have you found that's different now about this AMOC, or this overturning circulation?
Yeah, so we've been looking at ocean sediment cores to reconstruct what's been going on with this circulation in the past, because the problem is we only have direct observations of this current since 2004. And so we've been using ocean sediment cores to extend our knowledge of what's been going on. And we found that this circulation has weakened over the last 150 years, and we're now at the point where it's the weakest it's ever been for at least 1,600 years, according to our study.
Weakest meaning it's moving slowly?
Yes, so a more sluggish flow on the surface. And one of the techniques we used was we actually reconstructed the speed of one of the important deep sea currents, and that's shown a slowdown over the recent century.
Now, how have you determined this? I mean, as you said, you know, 1,000 years ago, we didn't have the technology we do today. So you've used sediment to try and figure out what's going on? How does that work?
Yes, that's correct. So we go out on ships into the North Atlantic. And in this case, we went off the coast of North America to Cape Hatteras. And we lower down large tubes into the ocean sediment and bring up these sediment cores. And this sediment accumulates over thousands of years, with each layer representing another year or another couple of years. And we measure the size of the grains in those layers. And those grains are important because larger grains represent a faster flow speed of that deep sea current. You could think about a mountain stream and how that's often associated with boulders and rocks because there's a lot of energy to move those boulders. Whereas if you think about sort of a sluggish Mississippi, that's a muddy, bottomed river.
I see. So it's interesting what the grains off the coast of North Carolina are showing you. What's the reason for this?
We think the reason for this is that there's been melting of ice that's been disrupting the system. So a key part of the overturning circulation, this AMOC, is the formation of dense water. The problem is that fresh water isn't very dense, and it stops you forming those dense waters. Now, 150 years ago, we were coming out of a period called the Little Ice Age. The Little Ice Age was a period when European temperatures were cooler, but also what we had was an increase in Arctic sea ice and extended ice shelves around the Arctic and glaciers. Now, that came to an end about 150 years ago, and all that fresh water that was stored as ice in the Arctic started to melt and go into the Atlantic, and we're proposing that that's caused the initial weakening of the AMOC. However, over recent decades, this weakening's continued, and we think that that's probably more likely due to human forcing causing things like the melting of the Greenland ice sheet. And support for these results have come from another study published in Nature this week by Levka Cesar and Stefan Ramstorff and colleagues.
Yeah, so there are two studies, as we said, that are out about it now. When you talk about human causes, man-made accelerators, what are you talking about?
We're talking about global warming, so greenhouse gas emissions, carbon dioxide, warming of the Earth, and it's that enhanced warming that has a number of effects. The one we've been talking about and the studies previously shown to probably have been important is the melting of Greenland ice sheet. But in a global warming scenario, we also have more precipitation, more rain and snow at high latitudes over the Arctic. And so that's putting more fresh water into the regions where deep water is sinking.
Yeah, didn't the AMOC also show as recently as in the 1960s that it was slowing down? And it recovered at that point, right?
Yes, so some of these recent records, including ours, we do see relatively slow conditions in the 60s and the 70s going through to the 80s. And then we see strong conditions through the 90s, and then we've had another strong weakening over the last decade or so, the period that overlaps with the direct observations also showing this weakening. And that's as we'd expect. There's interannual, so multi-year variability, decadal scale variability. But what we're interested in is the long-term trend, and that's what we were missing when we only have the direct observations. You know, it's all very well seeing that we've had a decline for 10 years, and that's really important, but what context is that in? And so by looking at these longer records, we can see if there's actually been this longer-term trend and investigate what might have been causing it.
There are some scientists who are worried about this conveyor belt shutting down altogether. What would that mean? I mean, we're talking about a channel in the Atlantic. How does it shut down?
Yeah, and so the reason we're worried about that is because evidence from the past suggests that it actually did happen during the last ice age. And it is possible that it could happen in the future, although at the moment we consider it very unlikely. And the AMOC's one of these things in the climate system that we refer to as a tipping point, something that can respond very quickly to a small change. And what we don't really know is, are we close to one of those tipping points where runaway processes could suddenly allow the AMOC to weaken much quicker than it has been doing? And that's really why we do need to maintain our monitoring of the system to try and see if we can detect if some kind of tipping point is being approached, and also to better understand what's the sensitivity of AMOC to forcing factors such as melting.
And along with the monitoring, is there anything that could be done separately from that to try and slow the pace of the slowing?
Thinking about ocean circulation directly, I don't think so. The only thing we really can do is obviously try and prevent global warming, because that's the root cause of why we think it's weakening now. With increasing temperatures, as I said earlier, we see a melting of the Greenland ice sheet. We're expecting to see more precipitation at high latitudes, and actually just the warming of surface waters themselves weaken the circulation, because you need to make the water cold for it to sink, and if it's getting warmer, it makes it hard to sink that water. So all these things that are caused by global warming mean that the AMOC is weakened. And so the only thing we can really do is try and mitigate against global warming by reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
By the way, when you said the overturning circulation shut down during the Ice Age, what happened then? I mean, what did that look like?
Yes, so when the circulation shut down at periods during the last ice age, it was associated with changes in the temperature over Greenland and around the North Atlantic more widely by up to 10 to 15 degrees Celsius, and it could happen as fast as 1 to 3 years. And so there were really large changes associated with this weakening of the AMOC. Now, it seems as if such a dramatic weakening would be very unlikely in the future, but it is possible. There's things about the last ice age that make it more susceptible to fluctuations in ocean circulation. There were huge ice sheets over North America and much of Eurasia, and they were putting a lot of fresh water into the Atlantic. And so the system was a little bit more sensitive or more liable to these collapses.
So just to bring this to a close, you don't think that there's a large chance of a complete shutdown of this channel. What is the thing that you do worry about?
Well, I think I do worry about there being a shutdown because we don't know with great confidence what the probability of it being of it shutting down is. We rely on climate models to make those estimates. And so what we want to try and do is improve climate models. And one way we can do that is by constructing these records from the past with which we can calibrate the models and try and tweak them and improve them. The models at the moment say the weakening might be of the order of a further 10 to 30%, which is still significant and would have noticeable effects on our climate. But the thing is, we can't rule out that a shutdown would happen. And that's why it's imperative that we do keep up monitoring and do continue to learn more, because the consequences of a shutdown, although it's potentially unlikely to happen, you know, maybe we're talking 5 to 10%, but we need to check those numbers, it would have really severe consequences around the North Atlantic basin and even wider afield.
Well, we appreciate your speaking with us and we appreciate your research. Thank you. David Thornelli, geologist at University College of London, talking to us about his study on the weakening ocean circulation in the Atlantic. Nice to speak with you, Professor.
Thanks very much for your time.
Propelled by the Me Too movement, several prominent actresses, including Jennifer Lawrence and Molly Ringwald, have come forward with stories of sexual harassment that took place during filming. Ringwald, for example, wrote in a column for The New Yorker that when she was 14, a married film director forcibly kissed her on the set. These kinds of stories have got film and theater professionals all over the country thinking about how to create safer workspaces for their actors. As a result, some theaters are now employing intimacy directors. Ashley Stevens from member station WFPL in Louisville reports, and a warning, her story may not be suitable for young listeners.
I feel comfortable with you touching my hip. Okay.
Oh,
with your left hand?
A group of six actors stand in pairs, asking permission to touch various parts of their co-workers' bodies. Shoulders, arms, feet. According to Alicia Rodas, who stands taking notes, this is an easy exercise in onstage consent, something she specializes in as an intimacy director.
An intimacy director is a choreographer for the intimate moments in a play or series or film, but is also an advocate for the actors in the room.
Rodas is a founder of the New York City-based Intimacy Directors International, or IDI, an organization of choreographers who specialize in guiding actors through intimate scenes in theater or film. In most workplaces, physical contact is not part of the job description, but for actors, it's often in the script. Rodas' job is to help theater companies establish procedures that ensure its members are comfortable with touching and being touched. Tonight, she's in Louisville working with Theater 502 on a new play called Nobody Bunny by Eli Keel.
Charlie is a success. His cartoons are selling like bubblegum, and the critics love him too.
The play draws from the legends of trickster gods in Native American and Norse mythology. It follows one such god, a Bugs Bunny-esque rabbit figure who in the 1950s decides he wants to be in the movies. Bunny, who shifts between male and female forms, begins to manipulate a talented young animator named Charlie. And one of the ways Bunny does this is through sex.
We'll find a place that plays some decent jazz. You don't have to talk to nobody but me. I'll feel you up under the table while I tell you crazy stories and you try to keep a straight face and sketch.
There's nothing too graphic shown in the actual play, a few passionate kisses and some light touching of Charlie's upper thigh. But regardless, Rhoda says her work is about establishing a safe work environment for the actors involved.
Reminding us that our actors have agency, that they are not props, they are not furniture, that intimate moments that occur are also the opportunity for very intense storytelling.
So how does this work in practice? Let's take the first kiss between actors Remy Sisk and Maxwell Williams.
So it's like turn, grab, to release people. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Can we try that just without, we're not going face-to-face, we're keeping like a few inches of distance?
Yes. So while we're actually kissing, my hands are still on his shoulders.
Yeah.
Okay. Rodas leads them through the kiss like it was a piece of choreography in a dance. They talk about motivation first and establishing consent. Then the kiss is done initially in slow motion, with each movement counted out.
Great. Awesome. So are you guys comfortable adding in lip to lip? It's really just placing lips to lips. So when we're getting there, especially because it's quick and dramatic, instead of thinking of like pushing your faces together or like...
By the end of the session, the kiss looked natural and the actors remained comfortable. Here's Sisk.
just because I have done all these scenes in the past and don't really feel much inhibition doing awkward things on stage, that's not the case for a lot of people. And she really makes that environment where everyone, I think, felt okay to say this is too far or no.
And here is Williams.
I guess as an actor, like, you don't want to be that guy. Like, you want to, like, say yes. You want to, like, keep it going. Like, it's just the essence of improv. But when the first thing she established was that no is okay.
One of the things that really struck me was just counting out the movements of a kiss, of an intimate moment.
That's Gil Reyes, the artistic director of Theater 502.
Treating that as this, breaking it down, take a breath, you know, and then putting that, you know, letting the emotion and intention later come to that, but building the structure for it. And that's not something I would have ever thought to do.
Reyes says he learned a lot from Rodas's visit with regards to the choreography of intimate scenes. But the most important takeaway, he says, was learning to encourage his actors to continue checking in with each other about their boundaries and comfort zones.
And in this play in particular, sexual relationships and physical relationships are so important to the characters' journeys that that it can use that shaping.
And Rhoda says this is perhaps the biggest key to creating a harassment-free workplace, something many people are considering in the wake of the Me Too movement and in light of last year's Not in Our House campaign, after several Chicago actors came out with stories of sexual exploitation in local theaters.
And we forget, you know, you are in a director or a writer maybe in a position of power and is also instructing their actors to do something sexual, which at that moment you have the ability to be Harvey Weinstein.
For Here and Now, I'm Ashley Stevens in Louisville.
Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins, in for Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.